Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
All right, guys, welcome. I'm excited this week. I really am.
Why?
Welcome to the Ryder Cup special edition of the Rich Hills Golf Show podcast.
Episode
202. It's Ryder Cup week. Mm. Honestly, I after this weekend's Solheim Cup, which we are going to talk about because it was bloody epic, I am frothing at the mouth, quite literally.
Yeah, it's a bit...
full. I know, it's a bit
why
weird,
is it blue?
I'll wipe it off for the Ryder Cup this week.
Of course it is.
I just, honestly, I am in so much excitement, anticipation. This week's episode, once me and Guy have chatted for a period of time about how excited we are in our Solheim Cup, we've got a guest on today, which honestly, stay tuned, because I think it's one of the most insightful podcasts we've ever done.
Yeah.
It was a proper grown-up conversation with... the course architect, the course designer of Marco Simone, the Ryder Cup course in Rome, Dave Sampson. We chat everything about Ryder Cup, the course design, how did it become the course it is now.
If you watched this week's, or last week, should I say now, the most recent Break 75, Dave made somewhat of a cameo in the video. This week, we'd sat down, and was it last week we recorded, or even two weeks ago now?
Last Monday.
And we had, like you said, such an insightful chat with him. He's such an interesting bloke. And I think people listening, truthfully, are really, really going to enjoy this.
So yeah, sit back and kind of wait for that interview, because this is going to be a bumper length podcast this week. Yeah, so I'm excited. I'm actually going to the Ryder Cup. I'm flying out on Thursday. I am there for kind of a bit of a chill out vibe on Thursday. I might go to the course. I might watch a bit of practice, but I'm going to be there at 4:30 a.m. Friday morning. I am going to be on that first tee box, front and center. Look out for me if you're watching on TV. I am going to inject that atmosphere into my veins. My blood will run blue this week with European blood. And I genuinely, I was there in Paris in 2018. It's one of the most memorable sporting events. Even just that Friday tee off, the first players teeing off, like, gives me goosebumps. It's incredible.
You know what's crazy? So I dropped you off at the airport to go to the Ryder Cup in 2018. Obviously, I didn't attend. And truthfully, I was happy that you were going. I knew you were looking forward to it. I wasn't remotely jealous then. I don't know why I wasn't bothered. I knew I was going to watch it on TV. It was like, oh yeah, I'm sure I'll have a good time. This year, however, I can't go. I've got some family plans, but I actually am super, super, super. That's three supers. Make it four. Super. Jealous.
Your Ryder Cup tone has changed enormously. And I know you still said last week about not sure what side, you know, you're not as fully committed to Europe. But as a sporting event, you cannot neglect its magnitude.
Hear me out. I am committed to Europe. I want Europe to win. Don't get that wrong. However, if it was, it never will be again. If it was still GB and I, or even just England, I would be even more passionate about it. However, I am European. Europe are going to win here. You've heard it here first. And I'll be watching the TV for two reasons. Firstly, to watch the Ryder Cup, obviously, and all the action. I'll also be looking for you in the crowd.
Oh, you'll see Ricky.
Yeah, we will. In the crowd this maybe week. You'll be in the swanky VIP bits.
I will be. Yeah, you're right. So you might also, not. I'm going to be getting as close to the action as I physically am allowed to without getting kicked out.
Am I right in thinking the Ryder Cup? You've been, obviously, you know. Is it the most rowdy fans you're going
to
meet?
It's amazing. Honestly, I'm trying to think now, how many Ryder Cups have I been to? I went to, obviously, Paris. I went to Celtic Manor in 2010. I didn't go to Gleneagles in 2014 because my daughter had just been born. That's right. She wasn't above. We were going to go, but you have to be 6 months or something before you can go. And she was only like 2 months right. old. Obviously, I went to, so I've actually, this has only been my third Ryder Cup, actually. I felt like I'd been to more. Celtic Manor was crazy. I mean, it was a really random Celtic Manor because it's 2010. You know, I could be proper Ricky back then.
Mm.
Like, this was way before the world of YouTube.
Yeah.
I went with, I was a lubricated.
You could almost be as far as Dick, couldn't you?
I was a dick.
Yeah, you were a
Celtic
dick.
Manor. to the point where I did face plant. I was running down a very wet hill.
Yeah.
And I face planted a path. Knocked my teeth out, quite literally. My two front teeth were cracked in half.
Are they not real then, your two teeth?
Half of my two front teeth are not real because of Ryder Cup.
Oh my word.
If you look very close, you can see a very faint kind of hairline wow. through the middle. And that was because of my friend. I went to Celtic Manor with my friend Jack,
right?
Surname Daniels.
Ah, nice.
So me... Dick, the dick.
The dick.
Me as being...
Big dick.
And Jack, yeah. My mate, he led me astray. Jack that day led me astray, and I ended up running down a hill, very wet hill, face planted the tarmac, ended up being, I don't want to say kicked out,
mm-hmm.
but escorted out and weren't allowed to return.
I wonder if YouTube hadn't taken off for you, where you'd be now. You'd be the assistant pro, pushing 40, still go that every weekend, as a little done-up Fiesta.
I'd be in a bad state. Yeah. So that was Celtic Manor. That was the Monday finish as well. So that was literally, because of the rain, it went to a wow. Monday finish. I woke up Tuesday not even knowing the result.
Really?
Yeah. So
sign of a good night.
So... Me and Jack aren't going this time, okay? Jack's not
you
gonna...
and Mr. Goose, El Grey Goosio. you've moved up in the world.
I can be Maverick and I can go with Goose, my partner. So, so then I'm going to go sensible this year. Paris was sensible. I only went for one day last year in Paris.
You've gone full circle. You had a spell in 2018 of, right, getting mature, a few kids under your belt. You've gone back now. Gone worse.
So Paris, I was a lot more sensible. I went for Friday. I had a great time. Don't get me wrong. I ended up in some very random French restaurant at 11 p.m. on the
in
Thursday.
France, did you? That's weird.
and that was a very eventful Friday.
Yeah.
So who knows, with three full days at the Ryder Cup, and I'm a problem when I'm excited about something.
I feel like I can imagine you getting absolutely bladdered, somehow wangling your way inside the ropes because you've played the golf course twice now and been around on a buggy once.
I know Dave Sampson.
Yeah. Koepka, don't hit it in that rough, mate. Just be a pest.
I feel like Koepka. Well, yeah, I might be a pest. So I need to be on my best behaviour.
Yeah.
I need to go with a professional mind. And I'm going to go to enjoy it. But like I say, my issue is when I get too giddy for something and I get too excited, which I genuinely am for the Ryder Cup, I fear for my own safety. How many teeth I will return with is going to be a big question
mark.
Well,
if you only lose half of one, that's an improvement.
And then I'm going to make a commitment right now on air.
Okay.
On air, live on air, live on Rick Shields Radio. Monday, after the Ryder Cup, I fly home to Manchester. I'm going to commit to being here Monday after the Ryder Cup in whichever way, state or form I'm in.
Yeah.
And we will do the 203rd episode of the Rick Shields Golf Show podcast post Ryder Cup.
I won't be here. I'm on holiday.
Oh, great. I'll be doing it on my own.
You're not here. No, I'm away next week.
Oh God, right. I'll be doing it on my own then. I'll bring someone in. I could dial in.
No, have somebody on. Have Matt Fryer on. Oh, you know, have Sophie Walker. She's free. She did some very good stuff for the Solheim Cup.
Well, we're going to come on to in a minute because that was that. I think that's why I'm more excited.
Correct.
Now. The Solheim Cup was absolutely fantastic this week.
And we need to talk about something now. Did you see my tweets?
No, I don't go on Twitter anymore.
Okay, well,
I've literally not been on Twitter for years.
Right,
since it turned into whatever it's called now. X.
I've had some thoughts on it, which
I'm gonna read them now.
No, don't ruin it.
No, controversial.
Not really, a little bit, but not really.
Go on.
Okay, so let's talk about the Solheim Cup first. It was amazing. I didn't watch as much as I would like, admittedly, but I did watch a good chunk on Sunday.
I watched Friday morning, so I put it on. The kids weren't really interested at first. So I put it on a purpose because it was early tee off before school. Put it on, and again, the atmosphere on that first tee was amazing. I would love to see a future, and I don't think we'll ever see one because it's almost two different governing bodies or whatever, however it all works, where you could almost have the female Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup on the same venue the same week. Like, if it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, female, you know, female Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup, and then go straight into the men's.
I like it. I also thought, and this would never happen, what about a hybrid?
Or a mix, yeah.
I was thinking this the other day, genuinely now, I think if it was six of the best European men and six of the best European women, and then obviously the same for America, that could be special.
Could be really good. So I think you could have all three. It could be a whole week of festivals. Like, I think you could have every one of those. You can have a female version, a male version, and a mixed tournament.
The All-Stars.
Yeah, I think you could have everything. I watched a bit Friday morning. It obviously didn't go the Europeans' way. They were 4-0 down in the morning sessions. And I kind of looked at it and went, oh, God, we're going to get battered here. We did really well in the afternoon to claim some dignity back. We did brilliant on the Saturday. Again, probably similar to you, I had family commitments on Saturday, so I couldn't watch as much. Sunday, yesterday, I was absolutely glued to it.
Yeah.
Like it meant the world to me. I was glued to every single shot. The caliber of golf played under that much pressure, it just blows my mind.
This is something I want to touch on because we've all seen it. You get the odd fella who's a gimp or an idiot, whatever, on Twitter who plays off two, who pipes up every now and again and says they could compete on the LPGA Tour or whatever, right? Nonsense. They're nowhere near the level. But one of the things I was noticing is obviously we know the women don't hit it as far as the men and don't hit it as far as we hit it. The ball speed is like 150 with the driver. But what they do, obviously it's straight every time anyway, but what they do that is so incredible, I have shots like 140 yards, 150 yards, it's absolutely stiffing it, like so close to the hole.
I think as well where they're phenomenal are those kind of 180, 190 shots where
hybrids
for you and me, it's like maybe a 5 or 6 iron, and for tour pros, it's 7 iron, probably Rory can get there. They're hitting these like hybrids with so much accuracy.
Ridiculous.
It really is. So
it's so good.
The golf was amazing. The head wall at the end there where she birdied, I think she birdied 16, 17 and actually ended up winning on the 18th. What a story that was, because she didn't get a start till Saturday afternoon and then she went out there in the singles. Unbelievable. Siganda, what a Solheim Cup it was
for
her.
That was insane.
She went 4-0. She didn't lose a match in her home country.
Didn't even
draw
a match or tie a match, as we now say.
I don't like tied a match.
I don't.
In fact, I hate tied.
What, the word?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hate the fact.
There's no half, there's no all square, it's all tie now. Very Americanized. Is it to appeal to the non-golfer, I suppose? Because all square would be like, what does that mean?
Possibly.
Tied so much simpler.
Yeah, possibly.
I don't like it. Don't like it.
It'll probably grow on us in time, but honestly, the golf was just absolutely incredible. And it was great that the spotlight being shown. I think that's my only critique, because normally Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup are on opposite years. It's only because of COVID they've actually now become on odd years. And my only fear, if they did become really close together, as in Solheim Cup straight into Ryder Cup, is that Solheim Cup wouldn't be maybe as spotlighted. So I felt like this weekend, it was all about the Solheim Cup, which was you look all over social media and it's just like, oh my God, this is such a spotlight. Mm-hmm. And from a personal standpoint, Sunday afternoon when I was watching, I've got two girls and a little boy. My two girls, 9 and 7, sat down with me on the couch and we were watching it. they got so into it. Mm-hmm. Like, they're asking me questions. How do you hit that shot, Daddy, out the sand? Or, and I was like, I don't really know.
Ask your uncle guy.
they were like, oh my God, that was such a great shot. And because I was showing passion with the European team, and I was showing passion when a putt went in or missed, obviously they were mimicking me and kind of somewhat copying my reactions and stuff. But they really got into it. And I was very, very emotional at the end watching Solheim Cup. I think any team event anyway, when I see happiness and what have you, I get super emotional. But sat there on the couch, I had one girl in one arm, one girl in the other, watching it. And I'm like, oh my, this is one of the best moments of my life.
The golf was in it. Leona Maguire is an absolute savage.
Oh my God.
See that putt by there that Roseanne gave her?
Yeah, was it dead long?
It was on, I think, 16.
Yeah.
And it was for the win of the hole for birdie 2.
Yeah, on 17.
On 17. And Roseanne gave it to her. I must admit, I was on the stepper at the gym, believe it or not, so I was watching, wasn't really listening
to
it.
It's like a four-footer.
Yeah, I don't quite understand why she gave it. The only thing was, Rose Zhang had about a four-foot off a par, and it was still her turn.
Yeah.
So whether she thought, God, if I miss this, or I don't know, but it was very weird. But no, it was...
Well, about 40 minutes before the end of play, I 100% thought USA were going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were dominating in matches. They were ahead. The projections got them at 15.5 points. And I know there's been a bit of controversy online. Well, European didn't win it, but the whole idea of that when you've the holding champions of it, you only have to retain it.
This is my point.
You only have to get to 14 points and you retain it. I would have loved Pedersen at the final match to have actually beat Lexi Thompson.
Well, she could have halved, I think, couldn't she?
Yeah.
And but then we would have got
14
point.
And a half.
Yeah, correct. You wouldn't have beat her, though.
Which, I mean, that putt that Lexi held on 17 was incredible.
Clutch.
I mean, Pedersen was in a super spot, but it would have been nice to take it down the last because she was four up.
Mm.
Lexi was four up with like five to play or something.
Yeah, no, I think she'd have missed that putt. I think we would have got the half in the end. But no, that was it was an amazing event. It was so good to see women's golf thriving, to see it being rightly so high on the agenda of just generic sport for the weekend, never mind just for golf or for women's golf. It was so talked about. The coverage was really good from what I watched. And I think for me personally, people may disagree or not, the week before the Ryder Cup, it really got me more excited for it.
Mm.
I felt like there was more attention on it. The fact it was all this back-to-back weeks was really good. If it was in, let's just say, March random time, I don't know if it had been as hype for it. I don't know.
March even next year.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was really... The only thing, and again, I put this on Twitter, semi-joking with some bites, but there is some truth in it. I don't feel super comfortable with the tie situation at the end, but only because... In some sports, I do get it. So let's just say, make an example. We've got Tyson Fury, who's got a belt in boxing, and you know he's won that, whatever, obviously. And then he fights against Anthony Joshua, and ends up in a draw. Well, Joshua's not beaten him, so Tyson Fury retains that belt until there's another challenger. I think that makes perfect sense because he's won the belt legitimately. He's got the belt. The other person can't beat him, so he keeps the belt. The only thing with him, team sports, and a lot of the response on Twitter were like, oh, it's the same in the Ryder Cup, it's the same in the Ashes, and they get all that, so it doesn't mean that could other sports do it, it's correct. I just felt like with it being a tie, to then be presented with the trophy, and not that they shouldn't celebrate, obviously, because it didn't feel right, it didn't feel like they'd won it. I think it shouldn't end in a tie. I think there should be some decider. And the other reason as well I think it's a bit dodgy is because, again, if you go back to the box analogy and Tyson Fury keeps the belt, Tyson Fury is always Tyson Fury. So if he draws, he's still got the belt. Then he fights somebody else and either keeps the belt or loses the belt. But with the Solheim Cup team or the Ryder Cup team or cricket, the Ashes, the players can change and do change and rookies come in and people go out of the team. So let's just say now, obviously, the European Solheim Cup have got the trophy, the cup. Then next year, if they draw and they retain it again, it could be literally a complete different set of players.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel right that's the way. There should be something, I think. Or the other argument, now this is controversial, it would have meant that actually America would win it, so it wouldn't be ideal. What about, we know there's a huge advantage being at home,
yeah,
the crowd, set up of the course. What about if it ends in a tie, a draw, the away team win?
I wouldn't like that one as much.
Well, no, but it's...
I get your point. I do. I get your point. And I think that's why I was so desperate for them to get to 14.5.
Correct.
Just almost like it was clear.
Mm.
We've won it. We have gone out there and we've won it. I think, like I say, the advantage of, as you mentioned it in boxing, it's almost like you hold the title and, yeah. and it's then for the challenger to take it off you. But then also your point of swapping players is valid. I think you've got some really valid points. I think what I'd like to see is almost each captain pick a player and they go head to head, sudden death.
Yeah.
And imagine...
That'll be in seven... Yeah, it'd be so good.
Like, imagine just starting from... It doesn't even matter. Start from the first hole, and the first player to win the hole wins the whole thing. Imagine the scenes then. Yeah. And that would, again, elevate the spotlight on whether it's Solheim Cup, whether it's Ryder Cup, because it happens in Ryder Cup as well. You get ties. And, you know, we've had it in the past where European have retained it, USA have retained it in the past. I suppose it goes back into history. It's probably how it was many, many years ago when Samuel Ryder set it all up. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's Ping, isn't it? Solheim. The Solheim family set it up. So I'm not sure.
No,
I'd like to have seen a definitive winner, yes. But at the end of the day, the rules are, if it's a tie, the retaining team win it. Yep. And the scenes afterwards, I mean, you had the bloody King of Spain there, all around the 17th. I mean, and obviously we've got some really good friends who were there. We've got Incy, who did a great job at commentating. Iona, Stephen, huge, you know, both friends of the show were both there in the action. And they both did an unbelievable job.
And Sophie Walker as well.
And Sophie Walker, of course. Sophie Walker was there. You know, to be able to, like, literally get a microphone as soon as these players have come off the match, bang, asking them really good questions, hard-hitting questions, and it was just brilliant.
Do you think then, question for you, I don't watch as much women's golf as I'd like to, and I don't watch as much men's golf as I'd like to, just, you know, commitments and the time it's always on, so I want to watch more golf holistically, and rightly or wrongly, and people might pick up on this and not like it, if I have to choose between the one I would normally gravitate towards the men's, I'm more interested in it. That's just the fact. However, whenever I have watched women's golf, and I've watched some of the majors or this Solheim Cup, I have really enjoyed it. If you think about it, like when Wimbledon's on and you've got the men's tennis, the women's tennis, and that's the one sport I possibly pick up on. I know football's really growing, but I feel like in tennis in particular, the women's game does feel as big as the men's.
I would say you watch Wimbledon regardless of who's on.
Correct.
If you're going to flip the TV on, and I experienced that in July, and my wife is kind of quite into tennis, I'll flick it on. I said, should we watch Wimbledon? And you flick it on, and it actually doesn't matter who's playing.
And it's the same when we have our, you know, British favourites. You know, we had Emma Raducanu now, but obviously Andy Murray, and I feel like we get behind them regardless of gender, don't we? I wonder if we had the Open Championship, if, I don't know how it would work, how logistically it would look, but if it was the men's and women's almost at the same time, at the same venue, or like you said, the week before or something, would that heighten the women's game and the interest, or maybe would it almost suffocate it and the men's story would? I just felt this week, for example, was a perfect example of them kind of, I know they're not the same venue, but kind of the equivalents coexisting together in such a close time frame. And to me, it feels like a big success.
They felt as close to similar events this year than ever before. Mm. Obviously, it's back-to-back on TV, which is, and all the graphics and everything will be the same for this week as it will be for next week for the Ryder Cup. It's the fact that, to some degree, you had one in Spain and one in Italy. That kind of feels, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's European, anybody. It's the same.
It feels like it's very closely connected. It wasn't on different time zones and things like that. You've got a lot of characters in the world of female golf now. Obviously, Charlie Hull was a great player in the Solheim Cup. You know, we know a lot more players now in the female game because, you know, you've only got 24 players to think about rather than, you know, 120 at a normal event.
Did you see those sections on Sky Sports of like Get to Know? And I'd like the team, ask them a question like, who would you least want to drive you to the airport or whatever? And that was good because you got to see the fun side of the team and the different personalities, and some of them are a bit more serious, some of them are a bit more out there. And that was really good. It has got me even more excited for the Ryder Cup, you're right, but I do think it was a great week for women's golf, and I feel like people like Iona and Incy and Sophie, I've said friends of the channel, who do such a good, great thing for women's golf, I bet they're feeling really proud that something that they obviously spend so much time in and around and are so passionate about has this week had such a big impact on the world of golf, kind of full stop. It was great.
Yeah, honestly, loved every minute of it. And like I say, the memories out of all... I've had a fantastic, memorable year of certain things, whether it's going to Augusta or Open or whatever it may be. But genuinely, that Sunday afternoon, sat there with my two daughters watching the Solheim Cup and them getting so into it. And like even today, asking me, "Oh, when can we go to the driving range next?"
You're
like,
"Music to our ears."
Oh my god! Like, it is because I've never wanted to be a pushy parent. I really try and make sure that I'm not pushing them to go to the driving range. I've spoke about it on the podcast before. They've got some new golf clubs, which they're absolutely loving. Little golf clubs, they're called. It's like Dolphin, but spelled with a G. And like, I've been to the driving range a few times. I only get them 50 balls. Mm-hmm. And they get through it really quick, way too quick. And as soon as they threw it, like, "Can I get more balls? Can I get more golf balls?" And I'll go, "No, let's go." And they're like chomping at the bit. Yeah. But I want to keep that excitement. And for me, anything I can do to fuel that fire at the moment, whether it's Solheim Cup, whether it's, I'm not going to be present for the Ryder Cup, because obviously I'm there, but whether it's they catch a bit of the Ryder Cup or they start watching a few YouTube videos or probably good fans, but like if they can start anything that can fuel that fire is good for the game.
I agree. I think for me, and I've said this before, I can understand, as much as I love golf, obviously you love golf, I'm guessing everyone listening and watching loves golf, I can also understand how people can perceive it as boring. And certainly if you got an absolute non-golfer, so you've got no interest and put, no offence, but the DP World Tour on a Thursday afternoon, and it's random guys you've never heard of, and it's the fourth hole, and it's so, I can get why people are like, "I'm not into this." I challenge anybody who's got even the most loose interest in sport or competitiveness to watch something like the Solheim Cup or the Ryder Cup on the Sunday in the singles when a player is going down 17 and has a putt of 8 foot to win the hole or win the match or win the Ryder Cup, the Solheim Cup, where it's so kind of simple in format and it's mano versus mano, so to speak. I think that is the best way to introduce people as what golf can be at its best. Because that is, I can't fathom how someone can't find that exciting.
I know. For me, it's like, it's this idea with the Ryder Cup that I would not, and I joked about Friday about being there at 4:30, and I will be on that first tee at the crack of dawn. Mm. I want to be there soaking the atmosphere in, because there's not a first tee like it in the world of golf. And that's why the grandstand is so huge, and that's why when we've got Dave Sampson on later, his design plans were to make sure that amphitheatre around the first hole was electric, and why you've got to have such a great Ryder Cup course with risk-reward drivable par fours. You've got to tailor it to that kind of middle section of the back nine, whether it's 13 through to 17 have got to be really interesting holes to make match play exciting. But I don't get like that. I'm not bothered about the first tee of the Open. Really, mm-hmm. Somewhat. They normally have quite a nice story, whether it's a local player or like this year it was Matty Jordan teeing off the first hole on Thursday. But I'm not racing there to be. But for the Ryder Cup and the Solheim Cup, that first tee energy, all the very way till the very last putt drops in. Yeah. Every single shot matters, and you could to some degree. I don't want to turn this into like a controversial kind of topic, but to some degree. When you look at the format of Ryder Cup or Solheim Cup, 3 days, mm-hmm. action packed. It's not 4 days of stroke play. Yeah. It's quite condensed into an area. It's loud. It's got music. It's got team elements. Mm-hmm. What does it sound like?
Live.
Sounds like live.
But live's rubbish.
But it does.
Yeah, no.
Like there's elements of it. Yeah,
absolutely.
But. I don't catch the feels with crushers or
exactly
smackers or whackers winning because I'm so like, because, and again, it might be how a more neutral fan maybe watches Solheim Cup or Ryder Cup, like an Australian fan or a Canadian fan or whoever probably watches it and goes, "I'm not really that bothered about it."
I think so, but I think there's two things that are different. I think with something like the Ryder Cup or the Solheim Cup, you don't really choose, in most good team sports where you don't choose to become a fan of whatever that team might be. So I didn't choose to become a fan of Liverpool Football Club. I'm sure there'll be comments below now, whatever. My dad was a Liverpool fan. I'm from, not too far away from the ground, etc. So that's just who I grew up supporting. I know your little boy's now supporting Man United because he's been almost told by you, and that's how it works.
Convinced.
Yeah, the American Ryder Cup fans and Solheim Cup fans are the choosing, that's where they're from typically, and same for us being European. So that makes it much more enticing and more exciting. But not only from a fan's point, also from the player's point of view. Like, and let's be honest, the players that are playing the Ryder Cup for America or for Europe are not only so honoured and privileged to be playing and to be picked, but to be representing their continent or their country, they're naturally going to have so much more passion, which will lead to either amazing golf shots and fist pumps, or it will lead to massive breakdowns and pressure and yips. That makes it so much more fun to watch. When you look at Liv with these made-up teams that nobody, I don't think, really cares about from a fan perspective, some do, obviously, but not many. Do the players really care? They're playing for the Crushers or for the Smashers or for the whatever. Not really. They just want to get paid. So I think it loses that real meaning, that real... Do you know what I mean? That's what it loses. That's what Liv lacks. I tried to watch Liv this weekend for a few minutes. I lasted about 30 seconds. Boring.
Yeah,
but that's another topic.
I think the other thing is, like, when you actually look at Solheim Cup or Ryder Cup, you're right. A lot of the reasons why you support those more, but also they're once every 2 years. It's not 12 times a year. It's once every 2 years. Like, whoever wins this Ryder Cup will be a Ryder Cup legend for 2 years.
Final one, then him. This is what I thought yesterday night. Final one. We have the Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup a week apart every 2 years. And the alternating year, the captains of the last Ryder Cup come together. So Luke Donald and Pedersen. Is it Suzanne Pedersen? Yeah, come together. They pick six from the men, six from the women of the previous teams, and they ballot out against the US.
I like that.
So
there you go. Free idea for you there.
And that's like, but it's a one day.
It's going to be called the Guy Cup.
Oh, it's 2 days. Yeah, it's 2 days. They have singles on the Saturday or the Sunday. So Sunday. The Saturday they have foursomes. So it's just two lots, but everyone plays the foursomes and everyone plays the singles.
Oh, okay.
So it'll be 24 points up for grabs. Would that
be the same?
Yeah.
12 from each side still. Just it's six men, six women, six men, six women.
That'd be class.
And then in the off season, you have a PGA Tour versus Liv.
Yeah. Wow.
There we go. There's some ideas for you, everybody. Right. Like I say, enjoy the Ryder Cup, everybody. We are just about to flick the switch and tune into this interview that we had with Dave Sampson.
One more thing is, this is out Tuesday. Wednesday, we've got another video at Marco Simone coming out.
So if you've not learned enough about the rough and the bunkers and where not to hit it,
yes,
Wednesday, we're going to do a better job to show you where we should hit it.
Correct.
Because we played a lot better on Wednesday.
And we did a scramble, so that helped.
That helped a lot. enjoy. I feel like there's more things to cover, but I don't think there is. I think that's it.
We did actually have a nice little uptick last week in people reviewing the podcast on Apple and giving us a nice 5 stars, and it meant a lot to me. Shed a tear. Aww. While you shed a tear at the Solheim Cup, I looked at my phone on Apple and just a little tear just fell out and hit the screen. So please feel free to rate us on Apple 5 stars or 4 or 5 ideally.
There's should we talk about the potential podcast golf day?
Oh, quickly, yeah, that's a very good shout. So just a quick one on that. Anyone that's coming to the live podcast, that is still going ahead. We can't wait. That's Friday the 13th of October at Marriott Worsley Park.
Tickets sold out.
Tickets sold out very quickly, which was brilliant. We've not really touched on it too much, so I didn't want anyone that's bought tickets think, not heard about that much, but it's happening. It's going to be a great day. We can't wait. But also in conjunction with that, the Marriott Worsley Park themselves are running the Marriott Worsley Park Invitational on the same day. So it's kind of not really massively aligned to us, but they thought they'd utilise the fact that hopefully there's people come in that maybe not played the golf course before. So if you've got the Friday off work and you want to play, it looks like a really good day. So what we have done in our Facebook group, we have shared the poster and there's also a link. We'll also put this in the description, the link in the description of the audio podcast and the video podcast. But essentially there's prizes up for grabs. It's 11 o'clock shotgun start up for 92 people. Prize presentation at 4 p.m. onwards. There's handicap prizes for first, second and third. Nearest the pins on all the par threes. Longest drive on 18. Obviously we're not playing because that would be mine. So it would really be a competition. We won't be there for that
and
bit.
I'd be obviously winning all the nearest pins.
Yeah. We won't be there for the Invitational, but we'll be probably around the facility probably 4 or 5 o'clock. So if you're playing in that, but you've not got a ticket, you might bump into us there.
I was going to say, it's not exclusive for people who've got tickets.
Exactly.
It's a first come, first serve, 92 spots. Get involved. If you are coming and you want to bring a mate, get involved in the golf day, and then we'll see you afterwards after a few bevvies for the live show. Right, without further ado, sit back and honestly soak in this incredible chat and information from Dave Sampson, the course designer of Marco Simone. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Describe the feeling when you first got that phone call or email to say you have been chosen and picked to design the Ryder Cup course in Rome.
Well, I didn't know that I was going to be given the job because, you know, at EGD, we have four designers. And EGD were part of the 2014 bid with the Italian Golf Federation. So initially, you know, we were just reviewing three courses in and around the Rome area. And part of that bid, Marco Simone was the preferred course as part of their bid. So then it was only 2015, you know, that Rome gets announced. And then sort of our MD came in sort of 2016, 2017 and sort of said, would you mind sort of seeing what you can do routing wise with Marco Simone? Just like, obviously so excited.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it's a huge honor and a privilege to have been given this, you know, challenge. And I say, you know, challenge because
I think it's quite a jigsaw, you know, because yeah. I don't know if a lot of people know this. Obviously we, first off, we had a great time in Rome a few weeks ago. Mm. Playing the golf course with you was honestly one of my highlights of the year, because it's great to be able to pick the brains of quite literally the person who plotted the holes. Yeah. So why the hell did you put that bunker there? Why do you think that was a good place to put the water hazards? Why have you made this hole so difficult? No, but it was
there
great.
Was a lot of it.
It was why is the rough so thick? I shouldn't have been hit. Your answer could have been stop hitting it there. But yeah, it was a real honour to be able to go around the golf course. But I found so much information from yourself in that couple of days we spent together in Rome. Sounds quite romantic, but
it was
in the fact that Marco Simone was a golf course, like yeah, there was already yeah. a golf course that was an already existing golf club, and you had to go in and turn 27 holes that was existing there into an 18 hole Ryder Cup golf course that was going to host this year's Ryder Cup, which is happening this very week. Like that in itself is a very, very complicated challenge and like you say, a jigsaw.
Yeah, I think that analogy of a jigsaw is perfect. Because it's not, you know, you're trying to, you know, we knew it was a blank canvas. We knew it was a new site that, you know, going back to the bid, you know, the initial bid was to like maybe stretch out a few greens, add a few tees just to lengthen the course. But to try and retrofit in all those jigsaw pieces that you mentioned, you know, that was too difficult. So we knew it was a blank canvas. But, you know, Ryder Cup, it's, you know, you're obviously trying to find, like any new piece of land, you're trying to find the best golf holes. But for a Ryder Cup, you're also trying to find the best golf holes for spectators.
And for match play format.
Match play format as well. But I mean, you know, the infrastructure, the roads, hospitality units, you know, factoring in 100 meter by 40 meter deep, you know, hospitality unit into, you know, the golf site, you know, then factoring in, okay, where the bus is going to come, where the people are going to come, where you're going to put merchandising tent, media, practice, all those sort of things.
Wow.
So it's a jigsaw.
I think that was one thing, obviously, that Rick said, we've been very lucky to play it recently. And obviously it was the Open Championship quite recently as well. We spent a lot of time. But being on site at Marco Simone, the infrastructure, it does feel bigger than like the Open, in a sense. Obviously the Open's massive, but it's quite kind of spread out and there's certain areas where there may be quieter holes and whatever, but it just feels like so much more vast. And I can't imagine what it's like to play there with those crowds full, but that must go into consideration massively, the spectators, like you've said.
Yeah, the spectators, and you know, as part of this, you know, the site and what it gave us, I mean, obviously there's a huge amount of elevation change, but there was a central core area where we try to route the holes. You know, we got the first in there, which is really important. Mm. But then you've got to factor in, you know, that grandstand that's going to be going around the first. But to get the first in there, and then the routing brings you back with the seventh, with hospitality around. And then obviously we're trying to bring the golfer back in for those key holes right at the end of a Ryder Cup match, 16 and 17, where you know. I mean, it is, you are sort of in a way trying to create a stadium.
Yeah.
You know, and you're trying to, for players and for the spectator, and trying to maximize that opportunity and that experience for the players and for the spectators.
I suppose to some degree, when you actually look at it the other way around, like an Open Championship, those golf courses are so old. Mm. Like they've almost had to, the jigsaw for those guys is trying to get the right amount of hospitality and grandstand merchandise, and often they have to sacrifice something like Royal Liverpool this year. They had to sacrifice the whole driving range in the middle of the golf course, and the layout actually even changes of that golf course to allow for it.
But
the old course at St Andrews, like that shouldn't be big enough to hold an open championship. But last year it did, with ridiculous amounts of spectators. Yeah. They almost have to go above and beyond to get that in, where with Dave's challenge of a Ryder Cup, it's like it is somewhat of a blank canvas, but you've got to now build a championship golf course that's exciting within this kind of stadium structure.
And that word that you've just said there a couple of times, and Dave said stadium, is true, because when we played again, very fortunate to play Hoylake Royal Liverpool with the grandstands up. Yes, you were hitting certain tee shots with a grandstand around you, and that felt almost like a mini stadium. But there was something at Marco Simone where a lot of even places, even in the middle of a fairway, you felt you were part of something. The whole place feels like a stadium, and that's without any spectators in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you do have those three-tiered structures, which definitely give you that imposing feeling when you're playing there. But I think, yeah, I mean, going back to the routine, I think that's one of the things, you know, getting that golfer to experience that, you know, first tee, you obviously want to get them into that, you know, sort of amphitheater. And then they, you know, they go off seven and they come back and they, you know, experience again. I think for a spectator, you're going to be, you know, you can just sit in and around 1-7, 16-17. You'll see everything. Mm-hmm. And that really did form, you know, the core concept of the routing. And yeah, you know, we know, British Opens and stuff, you're trying to retrofit in, you know, those stands and make sure that you fit everything in. But, you know, we sort of had that opportunity right at the beginning. And, I mean, we're very fortunate that Ryder Cup Europe and bring, you know, they've got all that experience, and you're working with them to try and, you know, maximize, you know, what that site has. Yeah.
More personally from yourself, and you talked about EGD before for our listeners and viewers, European Golf Design. When you first started to get into course design, okay, yeah. How many years ago was that?
Okay. So I've been at European Golf Design for 19 years now.
Wow.
But I have had a very interesting way into golf architecture. I was studying architecture at university, but my passion was always to get into golf. And this was in South Africa, where I was at university. And, yeah, came over because my grandfather, who is Welsh, he was very ill at the time, came over, and my good friend from university, who was in London, knew that this is what I wanted to do. And there was a competition in Golf World magazine, scribbled some entries down on a piece of paper at Heathrow, posted them off, and that was a foot in the door. Yeah.
And that was you designing holes or a golf course?
So this is just, it was just one hole. It was courses in Finland, which is now, yeah, very good golf course. So it was par five. And
did you win?
Yeah.
You won it?
Yeah. So that was the foot in the door. And then a couple of years later.
So what made that particular hole stand out?
To be honest, I think it was probably just the one closest one to what the architect wanted to look like. I was just a left to right dogleg par five, you know, reachable in two for the good players, but yeah, a couple of bunkers. You know, I think having done architecture, I was pretty good at reading a map, and you could see where the low is and see where the high points were, and just sort of, you know, connect the dots, and you know where you could see where the other green was. 14 green, it was the 15th hole. You can see where the green was in 16 tees, and it's literally, well, you know, if you understand a little bit about golf, you sort of know what, you know, what you're
looking
do.
For.
Yeah.
So that started your journey into golf architecture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then how many in this 19 years of doing it and being with European Golf Design, how many golf courses have you solely designed, and how many golf courses have you been part of? Because I bet that's a huge amount.
It's tough to say number, but at EGD, you know, if you've got a project, that's your project. We're not, you know, the architect has that job, nobody else.
Yeah, that is, you know, you're putting your name to that golf course.
It's an EGD name, obviously, but you know, we've got four architects in the company, and if any one of our four get the job, that's your job. You know, there are many projects that have, you know, seen the drawing board but not seen the excavator hit the ground.
Yeah.
And that's a huge list.
I bet.
But yeah, I mean, probably 30, 40 projects, yeah.
So of actual finished golf
courses? Oh, no, not finished. That's a problem.
How many finished?
Probably 10 projects.
Okay.
Yeah, 10 projects, yeah.
So obviously we've had Robin Heisman on the podcast before, who designed one of my favourite golf courses, JCB. He obviously is a colleague of yours at EGD. And so when, let's say, the Ryder Cup golf course, Marco Simone, is being pitched around, are you all, the four of you, are you all like chomping at the bit to get involved? Or is that the powers that be that's kind of said, no, Dave is going to be the best man for this job?
Well, you're going to have to ask Jeremy IMD that question. I mean, I'm sure secretly we were all, and quietly, we were all like a big amazing. Well, it is amazing. I think a lot of it was timing. You know, like I was probably just a little quieter than the others in the office.
No way.
I mean, as I say,
you're there twiddling your thumbs going, give me a golf course, please, Jeremy.
Just doodling.
Yeah. Have you got anything going? So you'd have to ask Jeremy the strategy behind who gets what job.
How much extra stress have you felt or pressure designing a golf course that in this week, the whole golf world is going to be watching? Like this, and it's one event.
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, you've had just the golf course has hosted Italian Opens, which it needs to do to be able to understand whether it can actually hold a Ryder Cup. I get that. But this is the whole reason why this golf course was built, is the whole reason of all those hours and all those sketches. And every time an excavator hit the ground, and they've been fully designed for this weekend.
Yeah.
That's a good point, that, because normally you build a golf course many years ago and it obviously gets some fame and some recognition, and slowly but surely it might then host an event. But to actually create a golf course for that bespoke event,
you create a golf course for 3 days.
Yeah.
Which is mad.
I mean, talking about pressure, I think I'm pretty much like to see myself as a duck, you know, like all calm on the surface. But the truth is, there's a lot of pressure, and there will be a lot of nerves. That I see that as natural, and like I'm just going to turn the phone off.
Be a silly question. When you say nerves, obviously things like the condition of the golf course, which I'm sure will be amazing, that obviously comes down to the green staff and the superintendents, etc. What is it that you're kind of nervous about? Would it be people poo-pooing certain holes, or the length of it, or what is it that's the bad things? And then what is it the good things that you could hear as well?
Well, look, we're all involved in golf. I think every golfer is pretty much an armchair golf architect. Mm. So everyone's got an opinion.
So that's where I point it.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I think the experience, we've got, some amazing holes on the back nine, risk reward. I think there's going to be so much drama. The golf course for the Ryder Cup, that is the paper. That's the exam paper for those 3 days. And I think, I think we've had three Italian Opens now. And you look at the scores, minus 12, minus 13, minus 12. You know, it's not an overly long golf course, but it provides a good challenge. And as I say, with those risk reward holes on the back nine, people are going to be dealing in, golfers are going to be dealing in birdies and eagles on quite a few of those holes, especially on the back nine. So I think, that's what, we hope it's going to be remembered for. And obviously we hope it's going to come down to that final singles match on the Sunday.
Which hole would you love it to finish on? Which do you, obviously the 18th hole is the 18th hole. Yeah. It's a wonderful par five down the hill, slight dog leg to the left, water down the left, a lot of very well-placed bunkers. Mm. But I suppose to some degree, that's not your finishing hole, is it really? Like, I'm guessing it's before that.
Yeah, I think 16 would be great. I think everybody will talk about 16. But I mean, there is something, it would be pretty amazing. I mean, I remember 2010 Celtic Manor and the throngs of people, running, watching that last match on 17T. I mean, that was something crazy. Amazing. Yeah.
I was there that day.
Yeah. Yeah. So was I. It was great. So I would love it to happen like that, because that was pretty special.
I suppose 16, and 17 to a lot of degrees really sets itself up for that huge amphitheater finish where you could literally have a crowd 360 degrees around 16 and 17, 16 being a short par four drivable with water down the right, a couple of bunkers.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Down the left, thick left, rough, which I won't go into during my round of golf. and that for me, when I actually think about the golf course, that's the hole I think about.
Yeah. Well, what was we our video? Will it be out yet of our match?
Yeah, because we did the match, which will be out. And then the scramble that's coming out this week.
We won't
week.
Ruin it then for those people that haven't watched it yet, those listening and watching. But obviously we and Dave was there. We played the 16th in two quite different ways. You went for it, I kind of laid up. But I think that's a true hole. Like, that gives that option, doesn't it? And I think match play, if it was a close match coming down to 16, that can really make or break the match.
I mean, I've got no doubt. Better ball, you know, at least one of them will be going for the green.
Yeah.
In, you know, foursomes... depends on the match situation, really, and same with singles. Well, that'll determine the strategy of that hole. Mm. You know, if you're two up, you'll be hitting a nine off the tee box, and if you're two down, you're gonna be pulling a driver.
Yeah,
yeah.
What's your proudest hole on the golf course? Which hole are you most proud of? And it's interesting because even though we're filming this pre Ryder Cup, and I'm sure a lot of listeners and viewers won't really know the holes just yet. Like, they might not have watched the Italian Open, etc. Yeah. They might not know the holes. Hopefully they've watched our video and learned a lot more about the golf course. But I think from what you say here is going to really help viewers and listeners enjoy the Ryder Cup this weekend. So any kind of insights, even talking about your favourite hole,
My favourite hole has always been 15, which is an extremely difficult par 4. I don't know, just always liked the way that hole sets up off the tee. Coming back to the routing and the whole rhythm of that back nine where you've got like three really birdieable eagles from 11, 12, 13. Then you've got 14, 15, which are really tough fours. I've just always liked the way that it's set up off the tee, and it's a really difficult hole.
Yeah, slight dogleg up the hill, raised green, any false front, anything short of that green is going to roll back down the front. Yeah. It's a long iron hitting into the greens off the back tees, even for the tour pros. They're going to hit in six and five irons into that green.
Both of us, or was that?
It's the hole where on your second shot you went left and you were kind of round near that tree.
Yes.
And you played quite a good pitch up, but I think it then rolled back down the bank. Yeah. And I hit driver... either 3-iron or 4-iron. I thought it was all over it, and it was actually just short of the green, just in that false front.
Yeah.
My really enjoyable stretch, and I'll be dead honest with you, I didn't know anything about the golf course until we went a few weeks ago. I hadn't seen much of it on the Italian Open. I'd kind of seen little glimpses of its social media, but not loads. So I was really fascinated and excited to see the layout of the golf course. I thought that the opening hole, I think, is a fantastic opening Ryder Cup hole. I really do. I think with that grandstand around, I was saying before, I went to Paris for the Ryder Cup in 2018. And I felt like the first hole was almost too hard.
Yeah.
With the water down the left, and you really had to hit an unbelievable tee shot. And so quite a few golfers hit good tee shots and end up in the water.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you lose a hole straight away, really. Yeah. Well, I feel like the first hole at Marco Simone, you can't lose a golf ball, really. You've got room right and left, but obviously it still rewards a great tee shot. And in the amphitheater around that first tee is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Front nine, I think the first time I played it, I wasn't as excited.
Yeah.
The second time I played it, I fell in love a little bit more with the front nine because you kind of, I saw a lot more of what, even just discussing it with yourself, what you tried to do with the front nine, I kind of saw a little bit more of that the second time
I
played it.
Is it five, the one after the par three, or is that six?
Five.
That's a good hole.
That's a cracker hole.
I mean, that's going to be interesting, number five, because, you know, at the time when we designed the course, we didn't know who the captain was going to be. So, you know, you're working as a team with Ryder Cup Europe, who've obviously got all that experience from, you know, hosting multiple Ryder Cups. But, you know, so we were trying to factor in a little bit of flexibility in terms of the setup. And five was the one where, you know, and the green had been designed accordingly. You know, like most people go, well, why is the green not on the lake edge? Well, we didn't know whether they were going to play from the back tee or they're going to play from tees further forward and give the players the option to go for the green. So if the lake was on the green edge, nobody would be able to stop a three wood to a green that's sitting sort of perpendicular to the line of play. So, five was one of those where we had to sort of factor in a little bit of, well, you just don't know what, you know, what the setup's going to be.
You don't think they're going to play that as a drivable par four, do you?
No, I do.
Oh, you do know? Can you share or not?
I think it looks like they're going to play it as a drivable four.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, for me, a Ryder Cup isn't about, because there's no end score. It doesn't matter if it was a tournament week and that course was set up to shoot 25 under, I think that's a good Ryder Cup course, personally. Because I think the divide between someone shooting 25 under and 25 over is actually not that different, the setup, because it's that risk and reward, personally, for me as a Ryder Cup golf course and a match play course. My personal favourite hole on the golf course, I love the stretch of 11, 12, the par 5, and I love 13.
Okay. Oh, well.
Yeah.
I think 13.
The par 3.
The little short par 3 with the old abandoned school in the background.
Yeah.
The two couple of trees either side. I think that is a really, and it's not long, it's only about 130 yards.
One, four ball.
Yeah.
That is honestly one of my favourite holes on the golf course.
Well, that would be amazing. I mean, a hole-in-one.
I,
there's such a hole-in-one pin on that on that green.
So like a front leftish one? Or
front left, front right, there's a little bank behind it. They can spin it back down, roll it back down. You know, and those are little things that we're trying to, you know, add to. I mean, the greens are undulating. But, you know, if you think about, you know, like how these players are going to play that, and, you know, having undulating greens, okay, it fitted in with the sight, number one. But, you know, like that experience of the spectator, like, you know, watching the balls rolling and maybe taking that slope or running off over there.
The oohs and the ahs.
Exactly. And that, you're trying to build that in. That's what we were trying to do.
Is it very different mindset to any other golf course that you've been a part of?
Yeah, it's been totally different. I mean, okay, number one, Marco Simone will be forever known as hosting a Ryder Cup. So you're trying to add quite a lot of risk reward holes, match play golf. It's been different. And then you're obviously factoring in, coming back to that jigsaw, just so many other things that, you know, I mean, yeah. I mean, there were quite a lot of challenges on through the project. I mean, you know, we had, you know, archaeology, you're in Rome, you got gas lines, you got electric lines. I mean, we had high power electric lines crossing the site. They all had to be rerouted around, you know, this phasing of the construction work, because, you know, ideally you want to build a golf course in one hit, just close it down. But as a members golf course, they always wanted 18 holes open for their members. So we had to do 9 holes at a time. That made things longer. And then we had COVID, which was, you know, so there was just like a lot of challenges, you know, along the way. Yeah.
That's crazy to think all that, isn't it? Would you describe it? Because I obviously we played it, and at the time, I would say it was a very, very difficult golf course.
Well,
and I think a lot of that was due with the rough.
Yeah, it was.
I think the run, I don't think it was particularly stupidly long, and we played it quite far back as well, didn't we? It
didn't feel like the rough wasn't long, as I said.
The golf course. We played it pretty much off the back tees. I didn't feel like it was
seven.
Yeah, it wasn't crazy.
No, I didn't feel like it was a cut. You're hitting a lot of five irons and four irons into greens, granted, but you get that on a lot of championship golf courses.
There was some holes I think that played easier off the back tees. What's the par five? Is it eight? We played that as a par four, isn't it?
Yeah, they're playing as a par four.
If you hit driver to that, it's actually easier than going off a forward tee. You have to hit a long iron, but...
But I felt like the biggest protection, certainly when we played it, was how brutal the rough was. Yeah. Is that something that's been planned? Is it something that's changed for this Ryder Cup week?
So, I mean, the temperatures in Rome get really, really hot through the summer. And in the past, in the build-up to the Italian Opens, when we've had it in September... You know, some of that rough, if they cut it back, dies. And then, you don't get that lush nature, that weep.
So it goes brown.
Goes brown, and if especially if you cut it too short, you're not going to get that growth through the summer. So it was a conscious decision, and unfortunately we just ended up playing. You know, they were trying to keep the rough higher to make sure that it stays alive all the way.
Of course, because it was hot when we were playing a few weeks ago.
So it was at a length that it's not going to be for the Ryder Cup. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, look...
Is it still at that length now, do you know?
Not from the photos that I've seen.
Okay.
I mean, if you go so far offline, it will be, still pretty high. But the thickness and the consistency is all being cut back and it's all as it should be. And, the great thing that Lara and her team, Lara being the head superintendent, the course was closed 28th of August. You know, they've got people, this thing's going to be... primed and dialed in, so it's going to be looking, I dare say, a lot fairer than when we
I must admit, there was a few, because it felt like sometimes it was almost you missed the rough and you are literally in a pitching wedge out.
Yeah.
Like it was that. I mean, I don't know, tour players are strong and they'll probably be able to get a 7-iron or a 6-iron on it or whatever. But it felt, and I'm glad kind of obviously it's being cut back, etc. And the reasons why you just said makes a lot of sense.
Even a step further than that, though, if you missed the fairway, there was a spot for probably 2 yards width where you could hit it. And then you might be losing your ball after that. Literally, you could miss a fairway by 3 or 4 yards. It'd be lost ball.
Yeah. I mean, look, for the normal golfer, that was incredibly tough. But I mean, in tournament conditions, you're not going to be losing a ball. There's going to be people spotting and finding those balls. But the maintained rough that's going to be maintained at, let's say, 90 to 100 mil, that's really difficult to play out of. So the premium, I mean, what we found, there was, a premium on being accurate off the tee. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the challenge that these players are going to face.
And is that steered via the European team, because obviously it's a European home Ryder Cup. Like it's our Ryder Cup, so we get to design the golf course. Then I'm guessing you deal, as you mentioned, closer with Team Europe, European Ryder Cup team. You're not particularly, the USA team aren't particularly ringing you up, and you're not really spoke to them probably one bit, have you? You've not spoke to them one bit. No. So when the golf course is being set up, and we were talking about this before, it felt like historically that the old saying was kind of the Europeans were a little bit more, not as long, but a lot more accurate, where the Americans would hit it further, but be a bit more offline. Is that still the case? Because I feel like now, when you look at the European team, when we've got Rory McIlroy, one of the longest drivers in the world. John Rahm, again, longest drivers in the world.
Ludvig Åberg.
Yeah, Åberg.
Victor.
Yeah. I feel like stereotypes change now, where maybe when Luke Donald was in the team, rather than being the captain, and Poulter and Westwood, and I would say that was a little bit more true. Yeah. But I feel like the European team now, even like Matt Fitzpatrick, he's not a sure hitter. No. Like, he's a long, long hitter. I don't see there being a huge difference in distance off the tee between Team Europe and Team USA these days.
No, I mean, the percentages are so small. But going back to your question about the setup, I think, Europe had success in Paris, and, Marcus Amoni is going to be set up pretty similar. Mm. Yeah. So, whether that is something that will, continue, who knows? But yeah, it would be fair to say that that people will draw similarities between Paris and Marcus Amoni.
It feels... I mean, obviously, European had great success in Paris, so hopefully for us, for Europeans, it's the same again. It was interesting. We've seen images not so long ago of Team Europe actually going and spending quite a bit of time there, because there'll be a lot of the American players that have never, ever seen the golf course or played the golf course before. Mm. First question was, obviously, that's the tactic that you at Team USA are adapting and understand that they need to know the golf course. Did you get any feedback from the American team, or did you get nothing?
Nothing. Well, it goes back, you know, that is the exam paper that's going to be set. So, you know, like, you know, that's the course. And, you know, and they will be, I'm trying to put myself in the mind of a professional golfer, but they'll just be like, well, okay, well, that's the golf course. Let's, you know, where are we strong? You know, I mean, look, But these professional golfers, they're all, you know, the comparison between Europe and America, the percentages of, you know, who hits the ball further, who's more accurate, you know, they are so minute.
I mean, it's something maybe I'm not educated enough, but like when you look at actually the European team and you look at where they play the golf, you've got Ludwig, Fitzpatrick, Tommy, Tyrrell Hatton, Victor, Shane Lowry, Rory, Rahm, Justin Rose, Sepp Straka. They all play on the PGA Tour anyway. Yeah. So I actually don't really understand anymore where this defining thing comes from too much of like, oh, the Europeans want this or need this versus the Americans want or need this, because they're playing the similar, the same events week in, week out anyway. Mm. We've only really got a handful of guys who are actually kind of true European Tour players.
I mean, I think that I think where Europe will be at an advantage is that every one of them, except for, I think, John, or maybe Sepp, a couple of them have, but the majority of them have played Italian Opens. Mm-hmm. They've seen the golf course and they've played it in tournament conditions. And, I mean, you know, you would have found, like, wherever you go, you know, like, the first game you played at Marcus Money, the second time you would, oh, I know this, I know, it's a bit better.
Yeah.
It's like everyone. The more you know things, the better you're going to perform.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think that's going to be an advantage. So, you know, and you know, you know where not to miss, or you know where the safe side is. But I mean, these players are so good that it doesn't take them long to work out where the good miss and the bad miss is.
No, exactly.
But I think having played it under tournament conditions, you know, is going to help, you know, especially people like, I mean, like you've got Nicolai Højgaard, past champion, Bob McIntyre, you know, they've played all three of them. I think that's an advantage.
With that being said, and obviously I don't know how much you want to say on this or not, and it's a couple of weeks late when this goes out, but were you then surprised that Maronk didn't get picked being a winner the last year?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was the winner in May.
So
unlucky, but there is always somebody that's really unlucky, and
he's always a 13th.
He was definitely that guy. I think it was a little bit of a surprise, but
When it comes to either course setup or design or whatever, and obviously then, as you mentioned, you were almost designing the golf course, not knowing who the captain was. There was then a change of captaincy during the time with obviously Stenson, then switching over to Luke Donald. Have you been in much talk with Luke Donald and that sort that team? Has there been much communication kind of around with the actual main people from the European team?
I mean, there has been some. I mean, we've had a couple of course works. We had one with Henrik to start with, and then a couple with Luke once he was made captain. So to be honest, you know, like the changes from, you know, the original design and then the input from, I mean, Henrik's input was, you know, he wasn't there that long. So we hadn't, you know, taken on board, you know, what his preferences were. But, you know, the change had been so minor, you know, like a couple of, you know, fairway lines and a couple of bunkers. Yeah, I mean, hardly anything, which is...
And are they doing that solely on preference, or are they taking advice from analytics? So that, you know, I know Eduardo Molinari is a huge influence in the statistics, etc. Is Luke Donald being influenced by that as well, or is he actually just seeing what he prefers?
Well, I think a bit of both. You know, and that's what, you know, you've got Eduardo, because obviously, you know, he has that stats business. He's Italian, so, you know, that's a massive positive. Obviously played in Ryder Cups, you know, in himself a great golfer. So, but I mean, Luke's going to have, you know, his views on things as well. So, but it would be fair to say that the stats side has played a part, yeah.
As a golf fan then, which obviously you are, and somebody that knows the course literally better than anyone on the planet, this week...
I know some parts of the course. Yeah.
Yeah. We've seen you play that golf course. I can't talk. Where does your kind of heart lie this week then? Who do you think is gonna win the Ryder Cup?
Well, as a fan, I always want Europe to win, so... That'd be great. It'd be great if they won like 14.5, 13.5 on the 16th. That'd be amazing.
And everyone's celebrating how good the golf course is.
And that's your one, but is that truly what you actually believe that are leading into this week? You do you feel like they...
I think they've got a great chance.
Yeah.
I do. But I do believe that, you know, I mean, this is going to sound so simplistic, but, you know, whichever team plays best, because the margins are so small, I think the team that plays best, I think you're going to have to drive it incredibly well. You know, you can't be playing from the rough. So, you know, drive it well. You know, you can look at the past winners of the Italian Open. They've all chipped really well, and down really well. So that's going to be play a part, I think. Look, they're all so good. The team that plays the best is going to win. But get back to your question. I 100% want Europe to win.
Yeah.
And then come Monday... Right after the Ryder Cup,
yep.
You'll be relieved.
Nursing a hangover.
Yeah. If the USA team win, he'll be in the USA team room as well. Will you kind of relief? Will it feel like, you know, a big weight's been lifted off your shoulders? Obviously, successful Ryder Cup, you know, people have loved the golf course. It's give you that finish that you want. I bet that's going to be a lovely feeling on Monday, just going, oh.
You paint a very pretty picture. That's the hope.
I'm also manifesting it for you as well. Like, I want that to happen for yourself, you know. Yeah. I mean, I feel like the Monday after, for a lot of people, it's that kind of relief that a successful Ryder Cup has taken place this year. Because it felt for a long time this year that the Ryder Cup wasn't going to be as big as it normally is. You know, I suppose for you guys as well, keeping your finger on the pulse with what's happened with LIV, and I bet it was like, oh my, this is the first Ryder Cup since kind of the inception of LIV and having as many key players as real Ryder Cup legends and heroes who have been part of the Ryder Cup for so many years. You know, this is a huge tournament for the Ryder Cup this year. Like, if it still is as successful as ever, brilliant, you know, and we're all hoping it will be. And it feels like it's starting to get to that point.
I think for me, obviously, again, this podcast is coming out a couple of weeks later than we're recording it, so I'm sure by now that the real buzz is there. But I think as well, for me, it does feel a bit like a change in the guard, so to speak. Obviously, there's no Poulter this year, there's no Westwood. I think, regardless of LIV, I think they and Stenson, I think they were kind of at the end of the career Ryder Cup-wise. You look at some of the guys we have got, and again, will put a bit more pressure on the shoulders of Ludvig Åberg, but it feels like it's the start of something new this time. We've got a strong team. You look at the guys, there's a lot of youth in there as well, and some experience, which is nice balance. It feels like it's the start of something new, and I feel like once the Open gets out the way and people start to think about the Ryder Cup more, it's an exciting one this year.
Yeah, I think well, the excitement's building for us, definitely. Going back to that point on the Monday, yeah, you hope it's going to be great. You know, we're confident that it's going to provide a good match. I suppose, you know, I've been involved here, for about, you know, 5-6 years on this project. So, you know, I suppose there will be a little bit of, you know, relief and a bit of weight off. But it's as I said at the start, it's such an honor to be, you know, given this opportunity. You know, it's like it's one of those once in a career moments. So, you know, that's, and it's just around the corner.
It's mad, isn't it? I've always personally, and I think there may be some listeners and viewers also of similar ilk potentially, I've always felt like I'm quite interested in course architecture and design. Like, I actually see a future down the line, you know, whether it's setting up a little 9-hole golf course, but actually getting into being able to design my own golf course. Like, what would I almost need to do? Like, I'm guessing just scribbling it down on a back of a fact piece packet of paper, like you did when you entered the golf world competition.
By a piece of land.
Well, yeah, obviously. But like, I am fascinated in course design, and I think I would take a lot of inspiration from
nice places that I've played and certain elements to it. And I would, you know, I feel like there's lots of, I've been very lucky to play some incredible golf courses. Like it'd almost be a hybrid of the things that I kind of like to see on a golf course, really trying to fit it into a piece of land. What is the actual best way of going around actually designing the golf course? Let's say you have got a piece of land. Do you actually just start sketching where the holes could potentially be and then start looking at the topology of where the land is going to be higher and lower, etc.?
Well, you're doing that all together. I mean, you're obviously, let's take, for instance, a blank canvas site, bit of topography. You're trying to find out, you know, okay, well, where's the clubhouse going to be? That's normally a good starting point. And then you're trying to see, you know, which holes, you know, would fit best in that land, you know, where there'll be particular green sites and tee sites that are good. And you're starting off by analyzing what those positives that the site give you will be. So a routing plan is the start, and making, you know, and I think if you get that routing plan, you know, nailed at the very beginning, you're a long way to getting a good golf course.
And do you kind of have a particular style to your golf courses, or would you, because, you know, there's a lot of course designers, like for example a Mackenzie course design, like there's traits that, you know, it's a Mackenzie green, or, you know, Alistair Mackenzie designed it. Have you got any kind of traits that you live by?
Not particularly. I like to believe that, you know, no site is the same. So, you know, let the land tell you what it's, you know, what's going to fit this piece of land best. There are certain things that you will tend to have on most golf courses. So as an example, let's say you've got four par threes. I always tend to like to have one long par three, one short, and two medium length ones. And I think, you know, if you know you're going to have a tournament, I think one of the things that you find a lot on tournament courses these days is just like really long par threes. I think trying to,
really long par threes.
Yeah, just staying away from that sort of thing. But then you're also trying to, like, you know, think about the shots of the player that you want to ask them to hit. I think Marcus Murray is quite a good example there. You know, like that course, you know, you've got left to right, you've got uphill, downhill. So there is a wide variety of shots on that golf course that we are expecting the player to hit. And I think that in an 18-hole, you know, new golf course, you're trying to make sure you ask those questions and pose those challenges throughout. I think number one is, you know, see what the land is and, you know, listen to the land and see what routing, what best greens, tees, and style will suit a particular piece of land.
Yeah. Do you have a particular favorite golf architect that you've followed the kind of journey of?
I think there's a lot of really good modern stuff coming out. So I mean, you've got your Tom Doakes and your Coors and your Crenshaws and stuff, Gil Hands, you know, they're all doing some really, really cool stuff.
Do you want to be mentioned in the same name as those guys?
No, let's easy one step at a time. Who knows where I'll be at the end of my career? But I mean, that'd be incredible.
What do you feel like you need to do to get into the same kind of breath as the guys you just mentioned there? Not saying you're not already, but what do you feel like you have to do to get into that kind of category?
That's a really, really difficult question. I mean, I think, you know, number one, these guys are extremely talented. But they, you know, they do get some amazing pieces of land to work on. And sometimes, you know, not every project is this amazing sandy waste area, you know.
With
amazing views. It's just, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's not. I think, but one of the, some of the things that, you know, that they do offer, they do give you a lot of options, a lot of width of the tees, you know. And I think that's very important, you know, just so that it, you know, you've got to, yeah, just give the golfer options, just give them, you know, make it a bit easier, make it a bit more fun.
Just following on from that a little bit, and this might be a bit of a silly question, but it's one that I want to ask anyway. Like, when I go to a new golf course, I often focus primarily, maybe naively and stupidly, on how I play. I then often would focus on the condition of the golf course, how well the greens roll and things like that. Maybe even the clubhouse and it sounds like the food they serve, etc. One thing I don't feel I'm qualified enough on and don't maybe think about enough is the course architecture.
Mm.
So what is there any kind of simple things that kind of normal golfers, if you like, can look out for to really appreciate a good golf course? Because sometimes, again, if there's obvious views by the sea, that always wins me over.
Yeah.
But sometimes I struggle to put my finger on if I like a golf course. It often comes down to how well I've played.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. For 95% of people, that's what it comes down to. Views help a hell of a lot. It's tough question.
I personally, I don't rank golf courses that I like on the way I've played them.
Yeah, well, really? That's a good point. People are different.
I think I rank them on view,
massively,
views and condition.
But that's saying the same though. But take away, so you've got condition and views.
But I can play terrible and still appreciate how good that golf course was.
As could I. So say for example, North Berwick, it's always going to be in good condition.
Yeah.
It's got amazing views. I could not play well and still enjoy it. But after that, if I went to a more normal golf course that's not blessed being on the coast, what else am I looking at? Is it bunker? Because, for example, you're going to hate to hear this. I'm not a massive fan of Royal Lytham, which I know is one of the best golf courses around. People say, oh, the bunker placements, but I don't see it. I just know where my golf ball's gone. If it's not in a bunker, great, hit it and move on.
That's an interesting point because I had the same. I've only played Lytham once. I had the same experience. The setting does play a part.
Mm.
And I think, you know, but people in our office absolutely love Lytham. They've played it more times than I have, and they appreciate the strategic challenge, you know, especially for good golfers.
Mm.
Like there are a certain set of bunkers on a particular hole which will come into play one day. Different day, it'll be different bunkers.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we go there, we are appreciating things like that. You know, like the challenge is asking, you know, does this look the same as that? Okay, well, we want to make sure that, you know, it's a different challenge, it's a different view. You know, you're looking to, you know, pose, as I say, different questions all the way through the round. And I think, you know, you're also, I mean, you know, Marcus Simone is not blessed with being next to the sea, but it does have some incredible views.
Mm. It does. You can actually see the center of Rome still on that 11th, 12th tee, can't you?
Yeah. You see St. Peter's on numerous tee shots. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, get that ingrained into your, experience of the golf course. But we are consciously rooting the golf course so that those views come at key points in the round. Mm. So on the back nine, you know, for a Ryder Cup, that's where the cameras are going to be. That's where the drama is, you know, and then having that as the backdrop, you know, you're trying to factor in, you know, those views. But I mean, like I could, you know, work project in Saudi, Royal Greens, you know, that was a flat pancake golf course. So you're then trying to add, you know, interest and challenge into that.
It's like we were recently at Crail. And there's some holes at Crail that aren't fantastic. They're quite bland.
Yeah.
But the fact you're on the side of the coast and amazing. The view is so good, it becomes one of my favourite places to go to.
Yeah,
yeah, it's not. I mean, that was
architecturally,
designed.
The actual design.
Seventh oldest golf course in the world. Like, it's not had loads of architecture design on it. Like, old Tom Morris kind of laid it out and it's like, that's it.
Yeah.
But, like, I love that golf course because of its position.
But if that sea suddenly got turned into a farmer's field, it's going to be the most boring course on the planet.
Yeah.
There's enough elevation to make it interesting, but you're right, it's not.
But I think that comes back to, like, also setup and the condition that you play the course in.
Mm.
You know, like at Marcus Murray, the rough was just so tight. Like, you go offline. And after a while, when we played, it was just like, you know, I'm in the rough again and I'm probably going to, probably can't find my ball. But going back to, you know, Crail, you know, you can hit the ball anywhere and you'll find the ball.
As long as you don't go right, you're fine.
So those experiences that you know, like, and to be honest, like, once the Ryder Cup's gone at Marcus Money, that rough's going to be cut down and the golfers are going to be able to find their ball.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's going to be a whole different experience.
There'll be a lot of golf balls being found as well.
That's actually a good point that brings me on to. I suppose these not resort courses, but Ryder Cup hosts, i.e. a Celtic Manor or a Belfry or obviously Marco Simone going forward, they make the revenue, I guess, twofold. Firstly, from hosting the Ryder Cup, that brings a lot of revenue in. And secondly, going forward, the green fees that people want to go and play a Ryder Cup golf course. So does that then, the setup must have to change for the more average golfer who's going to play it? So I guess they're going to have more forward tees, obviously rough will go down.
Yeah.
Does that ever come into your mind during the build?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, so and fairway widths. I mean, you know, they're like 40 yards wide for the average golfer. So it is factored in. But for the pros, they narrow down 18 to 25 yards. But you know, that's comes back to, you know, you wanting to challenge these guys, you know, and yeah, you want to, but with amateur golfers, you know, there are forward tees. You know, the course is 7,200 yards off the back, but it's only 5,000 yards off the front. So, you know, there's a big distance there. So, you know, right at the very beginning, you are factoring in, and you know, we know that 99% of the time it's going to be played by amateur golfers. But, you know, when we're playing it a month or you know, they're trying to get this course primed for the third biggest sporting event in the world.
So it is.
Yeah.
I'm going to go World Cup final. It must be the biggest. And then second, it's not the Super Bowl, is it?
Olympics.
Olympics. Oh, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a big event. So the rough is going to be cut down. It's going to be much more. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be much more playable. I dare say the green speeds might not be as fast, but you know, but people also go there because they want to be challenged as well.
Yeah.
So you're sort of trying to strike that balance between you know making people go around and going back to Crail, like. I want to play a golf course in the same ball.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing you want to be doing is digging in your bag for 6-7 golf balls.
No, I agree. I think just going back to the golf course and that Monday when you sit there, hopefully with a cigar and it's all going well. I don't think I'm not going to be going to Ryder Cup. Rick is possibly going now, which is exciting. So I'm sure by the time this podcast comes out, you know, and you'll probably be on the way there. But I think people who I can guarantee will have a good time, he's actually spectators actually at the golf course, because again, that first tee when we hit off and that amphitheatre around us, not only is that great for the spectators, there's so many vantage points and it's such a well laid out place. I imagine anyone that's fortunate enough to have a ticket to go and watch is not only going to enjoy the golf, but will enjoy the viewing experience. And this is no criticism of the Open, because it's a different kettle of fish, but it's so different to watching golf at the Open. I can imagine anyway.
Yeah, I think it's been bespoke designed for that in mind, hasn't it, I suppose?
But the site gave us that. Mm. You know, so, you know, we knew there was a lot of potential, you know, for the golf holes and the spectators. And I think if you compare it to, I mean, Paris was fantastic for the spectators, but, you know, it had embanking on.
Yeah, there was loads of greens with big banks around, natural grandstands.
Yeah,
well, not natural, made but grassbank grandstands. Yeah.
But I mean, that was created as possibly a tournament course back in the day. But the difference between Marcus Simone and Golf National in Paris, they, you know, you only saw that one golf hole, so you're pretty much waiting for, you know, four matches to come through, or even the singles more. But at Marcus Simone, you can find some vantage points where you can see so much more, because it's, you know, it's this 50 meters of elevation change, whereas the Golf National, there's like 5 meters on every hole. So,
well, I think the grandstand on the side of 13th tee is an unbelievable spot.
Yeah, it's going to be.
Because you can see the par 3, you can see the shots into 12, you can see the shots on the tee shot on 16, you can see the 7th, the par 3 across the water, you can see the 1st.
Yeah. Second tee shot.
You can see 14th
tee
shot.
Yeah.
Like that grandstand on the side of 13, I think, is unbelievable. I think you can see a hell of a lot from there. And I think even the grandstand on the right of 7, the par 3, you know, I'm sure that'd be.
The one I shanked it into.
The one you shanked it into. I think it's just a tradition.
Yes, it is.
You're very good at keeping tradition.
If I'm playing a golf course with a grandstand up, I will shank one at least.
And that point as well, even though you're a bit lower, and even on the left side of 16 is an unbelievable spot.
Yeah.
I think left side of 16 is probably one of the better spots as well. But you've got a fat side in mind.
I think that one on 12 and 13, I mean, every match is going to get there.
I love that one on 13. I could sit there all day, because you've got the hole-in-one chance, you've got the par 5, I just think that's a great spot to be in.
One question I would have, and this obviously isn't your role, but something I don't know if you've ever considered, I suppose some like the Belfry or a Celtic Manor, post Ryder Cup does get so much footfall because of the fact of the location, certainly the Belfry, I think. When we went to, obviously, Marco Simone and played it, we had a great time, but it does feel very much like it's a random place for a golf course at the side of Rome, really. How do you foresee in the future more golfers going and playing there? Do you think it's part of a European trip for Americans where they might do Rome and then go over to Ireland and Scotland? Or
do you even see the golf in Italy?
you know,
become you hope so. I mean, look, the Italian Golf Federation have the golden ticket, you know, and it's up to them to maximize, you know, this opportunity, because, you know, this is the biggest opportunity they will ever get to, you know, improve, you know, and increase the numbers of players in Italy. So, you know, whether people will travel, I mean, I can see people traveling from the US to go and play, you know, a Ryder Cup course, and, you know, taking their family, because Rome is one of the greatest cities in the world. So there is that attraction.
Well, the tourists, like we went into Rome. I couldn't believe how busy Rome was.
Oh, it was insane.
It was so busy, and so many Americans and tourists there that it doesn't surprise me if they shut the clubs in or hire a set of clubs and nip over to Marco Simone, because, like I say, it's 30, 40 minutes away from the centre of town.
And I think as well, a credit to you, and the whole point of what the golf course is set up for, clearly. But like, we had a kind of a somewhat friendly match, myself and Rick, obviously. But if you were going with a group of guys, it literally obviously is such a good match play golf course.
It really is. It's perfect for match play. If just a couple of last questions, I'm more intrigued on your kind of golf architecture background. What is actually your favourite golf course, like, from an architectural standpoint?
The Old Course, St Andrews. Yeah, absolutely love it.
Really?
Yeah, really love it.
That's really surprised me.
Yeah? Okay. Well, I've played it numerous times. Played it quite well there as well. Of course. But I just love the way you just can just plot your way around, you know. And, yeah, I think I like, you know, working things out. You know, wow. I love doing and just, you know, working out how to play that one. And,
oh, my God.
And it's just, and I mean, it's like, but it's like every golf course, you know, and every shot, you're weighing up that risk versus reward. You know, and I think St Andrews, you know, like, I'll just keep playing left. Because, you know, but I know the reward is going right. But I'm happy to take my chances going left and
keep your ball in
just
play.
Keep my ball in play and just steady away. And yeah, it seems to have worked.
I love the Old Course. I love St Andrews. It is literally, we were there just a couple of weeks ago, and we took some American friends with us, and I was actually quite proud to show them around like St Andrews. Like,
some people don't get it though. Sometimes, you know, because it is quite, initially you're like, it's quite a, you know, flat, yeah, flat visually.
But for me, it'll always rank high. Maybe not from a golf architectural standpoint, from experience, because the emotion is just so good. I've been lucky enough to play it five or six times now. Stand that first tee. There's nothing. I don't feel nerves like it anywhere else in the world. Like, it is just, but it's like, it's not nerves from a bad shot. It's more like pressure that you stood somewhere where everyone stood. This is the Holy Grail. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. If tomorrow you went back to European Golf Design, okay, meeting, guys, new project. Dave, it's your next project straight after Marco Simone, which you might already be on. Where would that site be? What's your dream site? And you don't have to measure it by...
Sandy site on the CH would be amazing.
That is it.
That bit of land next to Muirfield.
Yeah. Oh, there we go, that one.
Have you seen that?
Oh, it's incredible.
The land that Muirfield owns, but they've not done anything with it yet.
It's incredible. Yeah, there we go. That would be a dream site.
That would make one of the best golf courses.
One more question before we wrap this up. Maybe give our listeners, we've got a lot of people listening, obviously, clearly you're hardcore golfers. Let's take the Old Course out of it. Maybe give them a golf course you should go and play that's a top one they will have heard of, but then maybe a bit more of a hidden gem that you think kind of deserves a bit of love. So let's just say you might go with, you've got to go and play Carnoustie, for example. I think you've got Carnoustie top on.
I didn't enjoy Carnoustie.
What's a big course people will know of that you think should go and play, but then maybe a bit more of a hidden gem that's maybe a bit more realistic for price point, etc.?
Well, I think Cruden Bay.
Yeah.
Cruden Bay, I think that's fantastic. this one also happens to be on a coastal site, but I went to university in a place called Port Elizabeth. It was really windy, so... You know, I enjoy playing in the wind. It just happened, well, Cruden Bay, we played in a gale. And then this other course also played in the gale, and it was on the, you know, it was on the west coast of England. But I thought Parinporth, if you've ever been down to Cornwall.
What's that one called?
Parinporth.
Parinporth.
Yeah.
Not heard of it.
Lovely, amazing course.
I did Cruden Bay.
If you like rugged, rugged golf experience, blind holes, up, down, all over the place. It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I did Cruden Bay with Sir Nick Faldo, and it was so outrageously windy. We played like five holes, and it was near enough unplayable. We're the only ones out there. But the sight was... I'd love to play it on a lovely car. Yeah. And
that's another thing that massively changes your perception. We went there, it was such bad weather. All we were thinking about really was, let's get in, I hope the audio was okay on this video. If that was a nice summer's evening, I think we'd have walked away going, that's the best course on the planet.
Yeah, it's lovely. The good thing about five is it sort of comes close to the clubhouse again.
I think we actually started on the par three near the village.
Okay.
Like the fourth or something.
Yeah, fourth.
We started on that hole. We did a bit of cross country. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We played a bit of everywhere. Designed a hole while we were out there. Our last hole, Faldo was stuck. We were up on this big tee box. I can't remember what hole it was now. And we played backwards down this hill. We made this par three, which was unbelievable. But the elevation change was ridiculous.
You've already started your foray into golf course architecture.
I honestly, as I've played more golf courses, I appreciate views a lot, and I think I measure golf courses a bit too much on views, but I definitely appreciate nice, designed, well thought out, risk reward, not too punishing. I don't think I'd make my golf course too punishing or too difficult. I think you can make it harder without making it longer as well.
Yep.
I think obviously tour golf is very much about 7,500 yard golf courses now. I don't think you need to make a golf course longer to make it harder. You can be clever in the way that you make fairways narrower, put pins behind at certain spots. I think they did a good job at that with the old course last year, because that could have been ripped. If that was just on a normal July, not having an open, it would have been 30 under, 40 under. But the fact they managed to keep the score, was it 20 under, I think Cam Smith ended up winning, or 19 under. That was fairly acceptable, considering they've not lengthened the golf course that much past 17. But yeah, I would love to get into it. I think in the future there'll be a Rick Shields golf designed course. I think then I'll probably go Ryder Cup. I'll probably design a Ryder Cup course. Cool. Do you know what I mean?
Forget that. It can't be that hard, can it? Maybe they might move to Masters. They'll go, you know what? I've had enough of Augusta.
Yeah, do you think?
It's not its day, Augusta. Let's go to the Rick Shields course.
Or maybe they'll let me redesign Augusta.
Correct.
They might just say, listen, we're gonna take the whole place up. Here's the keys.
I think a big windmill down 18.
Every hole would be a par five dogleg left.
T-Rexes and stuff. Let's do it.
Excellent, Dave. You've been amazing. Good luck this week.
Thank you very much.
I feel nervous for you. But you've done an amazing job. I think it's a golf course that definitely, when we played it, it grew on me. I liked it the first time. I loved it the second time. I think the guys for the Ryder Cup are going to really, really enjoy it. I think from a match play perspective and a Ryder Cup golf course, it's going to be amazing. For spectators, it's going to be even better. And hopefully Monday I'll see you. We'll both be hungover, smoking a big fat cigar, celebrating your triumph.
And a Europe win.
Yes.
And a Europe win.
Got one more question for you, Rick, before we wrap this up. So, right, tomorrow's a fictional day. It's a sunny day, okay?
Okay.
There's a private jet outside for you ready, or a helicopter, whatever you please. You can either go and play Marco Simone or JCB, which was also designed by Robin. European Golf Designs.
Whoa. Well, the thing is, if I had a private jet, I think it'd be wasted on JCB.
Yeah, good answer.
So, a helicopter's a different question. But, obviously, you've got different designs, perspectives on it, but I like both golf courses a lot, and I think the more I've played them, and I've played obviously JCB a hell of a lot, I enjoy it more I play it. Yeah. And I think with Marco Simone, I would love it more I played it.
I think
I'm getting a bit like that now with golf courses. It's probably harder for me to judge a golf course I've only played once. I think I'm actually starting to appreciate playing it once and going, I like that, playing it again and going, you know, I really like that. Playing it again and going, you know, I actually love it. Do you know? And I think that's...
Maybe we need one more trip to Italy than to Rome, the three of us.
Yeah, Monday after the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, a little... Yeah.
With our cigars and champagne. Right, guys, everyone, thanks for listening. Dave, good luck with everything. And enjoy the Ryder Cup, everyone. It's going to be epic. Go Team Europe, and we'll see you next week.
Time
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.